And we find ourselves in a very lonely position. There is a great loneliness in leadership. But I repeat, we have to live with ourselves. A man has to live with his conscience. A man has to live up to his inner feelings. And I think just as a nation does. And we must face that situation. And I think that's all I'd like to say about it today. I know of few alternatives with which we can live, other than the alternative, I think, with which we are immediately faced.
You have tuned in to another episode of the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankum. I am the creator of Leading LDS, an online platform to help you figure out leadership problems. David Goetz started the Goetz Notes blog as a suggestion from one of his children. Since then, he's been growing in popularity, and the content is very thought-provoking. You will find a smorgasbord of topics on his blog, but many are focused around the doctrines of Jesus Christ and very well researched indeed. David is also the grandson of President Harold B. Lee and has many fond memories of his time learning from an inspired grandfather. I took the time to sit down with David and asked some simple questions about being the grandson of a prophet, speaking his mind to the world through his blog, how he approached home teaching as Elders Quorum president, and we even discussed the science of conducting sacrament meeting. How are you, David?
Fine. Thanks, Kurt, for inviting me.
Well, I'm glad you took some time with me, and maybe give us a little bit of your background. You know, in Leading LDS, we are always striving to learn from leaders, and leaders come in various forms in life. And maybe tell us about where your upbringing, where you're from, and what makes David Goetz the man he is today?
The short answer to that is that I grew up in Salt Lake, and it's a very boring story because I think we may have lived in, since I was married, I think we may have lived in three homes in all of those years. And so we started, wow. I started in Salt Lake, on the avenues, went to East High School, and then graduated from the University of Utah. And when we got married, we lived out on Ashton Circle. That was our first home. And then we moved up to Indian Hills. And then we went from there to where we are today, which is the most beautiful place on earth. We call it the ranch. As I look out the window, I'm looking up the Mirror Lake Highway toward Mount Baldy. So that's where I am today.
And what city is that?
Woodland. Can't be really called a city. The only building that would qualify is the LDS Chapel in Woodland. So you can't really call it a city.
I see. Well, that sounds like my type of city, getting away from it all and kind of being in your own kingdom out there in Woodland. So that's great. And growing up, so you kind of had a very traditional Salt Lake Mormon boy upbringing. Would you classify it that way?
That's exactly what it was, just as idyllic as it gets.
Okay, good. Did you serve a mission as a young man?
I did. I went to England. I was serving in the North British Mission a few years after the mission was created. So I had a great experience there.
Okay, and anything in particular stand out on that experience? Was any life-changing moments there, testimony builders, those types of things?
Oh, there were a thousand experiences that built faith and testimony in that experience, and I think maybe the highlight of that whole experience where I really gained my deep and abiding love of the Scriptures was when my grandfather, Harold B. Lee, came to visit the mission, and he was there for 3 days, and I got to squire him around with the mission president, and that was a life-changing experience. That's what really I think gave me the passion, if that's the right word, for understanding the scriptures. The fellow that I was with when we had him there was one of the assistants, and he plied him with questions the whole 3 days. I didn't even know what the questions were. And my grandfather would turn to his scriptures and he'd open them up and answer the questions. And it was a very stimulating experience for me. And I always thought from that moment on, I really wanted to be in a position where I could do the same thing, where the scriptures would be so familiar to me that I could answer people's questions from the scriptures. And so that really set the stage, I think, for the whole rest of my life in that one experience.
Wow, cool. So from there, you kind of it gave you a foundation of scripture study and like you said, a passion of scripture study that is prominent in your life today.
Right.
Well, good. And then you mentioned, I guess, one thing that sets your traditional Mormon boy upbringing is your grandfather. Most Mormon boys know of the prophet, but few have the opportunity to call him grandpa like you did. And I have, a few months ago, I read Harold B. Lee's biography, which was written by your father and really benefited from the simple lessons of not only leadership, but of being a father and a grandfather. When he came to your mission, was he president of the church at that time or in the first presidency or?
No, it was 1967, and he was in the Quorum of the Twelve, and he was touring missions in Europe, and he just conveniently arranged for a weekend in Harrogate, and so he came to our mission headquarters in England, and the whole premise was that he was on official church business, but I knew better. He was there just to see me, and we had a glorious 3 days together.
Nice. Well, hey, if you might as well stop by and visit family if you have the authority to set the schedule, right?
I was always grateful for that trip.
That's great. And speaking, just if you'll allow me, I'm just looking through my notes that I took as I read. Again, your father was is Brent Goetz, is that right?
Right.
And so he married, is it Harold B. Lee's oldest daughter? Is that right?
Younger daughter. They had two daughters, and my mother was Helen, okay. And her older sister was Maureen.
Okay. One expert from the book I'm just pulling up here, it's just a short paragraph, but as far as teaching about the father he was and the grandfather he was, if you'll allow me, I'll just read it real quick. It says, a favorite family story tells how Grandfather Harold B. Lee placed the highest priority upon the rearing of children. Helen has retold it many times to teach many lessons. She says, while I was serving as a chorister in our ward release society when our first two sons were about 2.5 and 4 years of age, I'd arranged with mother to come and tend my little boys, and I attended a Friday afternoon stake leadership meeting. Mother called earlier that morning, however, to say that she had awakened with a bad cold and wouldn't be able to come. She felt badly to disappoint me, but I assured her that I could arrange with our pianist to excuse me and to bring the information that would be given at the meeting. Sometime mid-morning, the phone rang again. This time it was my father. Calling from his office in the Quorum of the Twelve, he said, "Dear, you plan to go to your meeting and I'll come tend the boys." I was appalled at such an idea and strongly protested, but he persisted and asked teasingly, "Don't you think I'd be an acceptable babysitter?" "Of course," I replied, but well, I just couldn't have you do that. I'd feel like I was thwarting the work of the Lord to have you leave your important work at the office just to come and tend my babies. He replied with sobering and taught me important lessons. "Why, my dear, who is it to say which is the most important work of the Lord? To stay at my desk at the church office building or to tend two choice little grandsons while their mommy goes to the Relief Society meeting?" He came, I went to my meeting, and two little boys were blessed that day by the full attention of a loving, devoted grandfather. I thought that was such a perfect leadership lesson on balancing family and responsibilities and so forth. Do you even remember that day or?
I don't remember that day specifically, but we were living at a little home out in Rose Park, which was a subdivision that was started after World War II, and it was filled with young families. My dad was the bishop of the ward, and I remember him coming to that little house to help with the landscaping, and he built a sandbox for us, and he was a very hands-on grandfather. In fact, there came a moment in time when there's a story about a telephone pole that had to be moved, and I think he got a little bit too directly involved with city leaders with having that telephone pole moved to the benefit of his family. So he was a very involved patriarch, and certainly he taught those lessons well.
That's great. Well, the great stories. I really benefited from many of those, and he shares, it's obvious, the love he had for not only his children but his grandchildren. And I guess, is it true that he had the nickname for you that was Skipper? Is that right?
Skipper was his nickname for me. I was the oldest of the grandchildren, and I was taught at an early age that I was supposed to skipper them through the vicissitudes of life. I'm not sure how well I succeeded, but that was his carved out role for me.
Yeah. So has the nickname stuck at all? Does anybody else call you Skipper, or was it just between you and your grandfather?
That was just between me and him. No one else ever called me that.
Okay. All right. Well, I will refrain from calling you that for the rest of the interview. So. Well, cool. So, and maybe we'll touch a little bit more on your grandfather, and obviously it sounds like your father also taught you some great leadership lessons throughout your life. So after your mission, where do things go from there? I assume you met your wife soon thereafter, and is that right?
Yes. I got home from my mission you're testing my memory now. It was February of 67, and we were married in December of 60, let's see.
Oh, okay.
No, wait a minute. I'm sorry. I left on my mission in 67, so I got home in 69. We were married in December of 1969.
Oh, cool. Okay. And have you had the same, did you start a career at that point that you've had since then, or what's your work timeline look like?
I've been involved in finance and management almost my whole working life. In fact, my degree from the University of Utah was a double major in finance and management. And almost everything I did in the years that ensued revolve around that. Today, I'm fortunate to be involved with a company called PackSize, where I'm the sales trainer. And having a wonderful time and late in life, they tolerate my gray hair very well, and I try not to tell them everything I know all at once. I have to parse it out in small doses, but I'm having a great time doing that and really enjoying it.
Cool. Okay. And so you're still working today in that industry then? Oh, good. Right on. So throughout your married life, obviously I assume you were quite faithful and active in the church. And one thing I always try and clarify, I never want people to feel like you have to be in a quote-unquote leadership position, bishop, stake president, those types of things, to be a leader in the church or to learn leadership skills. So, but obviously those experiences teach quite a bit of leadership, and you learn the type of leader you are. And so throughout your time in the church as an adult, what different callings have you had that have helped your leadership ability and taught you the most about leadership?
I think as I reflect back, and I've said this many times, the place where I felt like I learned the most and had the most impact was when I served as an elders quorum president. I had a unique situation because I served in a ward that was relatively close in proximity and boundaries. I had two counselors and two secretaries in that experience, where we worked together closely for almost 5 years with no change, which back in those days was really rare. And we grew to love each other as brothers.
Yeah.
We had almost 96. It fluctuated a little bit up and down, but we had 96, on average, about 96 elders in our quorum. We had a wonderful experience together. And my whole philosophy in that experience was that every member of our quorum deserved a visit from the elders' quorum. So we emphasized home teaching a lot. We did a lot in personal priesthood interviews, and I felt like that was really where I felt like I made the most impact in church leadership.
So it was more of you learned a lot about ministering, it sounds like, putting the numbers or, all the hard work of the paperwork aside and focusing on visits and those types of things. That's cool. Any other experiences or callings that...
I love my time as a bishop. I really enjoyed that assignment. I served in the University of Utah, University 3rd Ward in the Married Stake, and I was on the High Council there, and then after that I served as a bishop of one of the other wards, and loved that experience very much because of the quality of the young people that attended. They didn't have to be there. It was an option to come, and they were there because they chose to be there and chose to participate, and that was a wonderful experience to rub shoulders with really, really great young people. And I was advised to take our whole family with me when we served. And so I assigned the cream of the crop to teach my children in Sunday school. And we were the primary. We had 10 children at the time. And I got the best of the best to teach my children. So it was a wonderful experience. So we really had fun doing that.
Wow. So you had 10 children. Is that the max you hit there for his 10 children?
No, we ended up with 13, and our youngest was a SIDS baby, and she died at 7 weeks, and so we had 12 remaining. And just last week, our baby was sealed in the temple, the last of 12 children, and so it's a great time of life for us right now.
Well, good. So let's go back as far as the way I came across your you and your content you put out there is you have a blog that's thegoatskids.blogspot.com. Now where did this blog start, and what was your motivation in starting to blog?
It's a great question. The suggestion came from a daughter who said, "Dad, you need to start a blog so that we can capture all of your writings and everything that you've taught us." So that's how it started. And my first response was, "Well, what's a blog?" Because I had no idea what that was. And it started 5 years ago with an email that I sent out to all my family, reporting on a funeral that I'd been to that day, and it was in July of 2009, and it was the mother of my dearest friend in life, and I was summarizing for my children in the email the experience that I'd had of going to her funeral. And so that she said, "Rather than just send out an email, why don't you organize it in a blog?" So that's how it started. And then as I got into it, and as I started writing more and more, someone suggested that I change the title, and I don't even remember who it was, but the Goat's Notes kind of stuck, and that's what it became, and that's what it is today.
Okay, so but it's still that URL with thegoatskids.blogspot.com, but you call it the Goat's Notes, right?
Right, yeah, you can find it either way. It's the only one out there.
And so And on your blog, you've got everything from, personal experiences to political viewpoints to very deep doctrinal studies and sharing some of your research that you've done there. Is there any method to the madness? You just kind of, whatever's on your mind, you blog about it and get it out there?
There was a time when I was really prolific, when I would wake up in the morning bristling with ideas about what to write about that day. And I was really prolific during that stage, but I've slowed down a little bit in the last year or two. I've just gotten really busy in my work and haven't had the bandwidth to do as much as I did in the beginning stages. But it stands up pretty well. When I go back and look at what I wrote, even a few years ago, I still like what I did. So I guess the method to the madness is it's whatever I felt impressed at the moment to write. And a lot of that kind of tended around my political views, which were tied to my religious views. And I made no apology for it. In fact, I think the tagline is still there, that I still think that religion and politics are not taboo topics, and we should be talking about them.
Right on. So, do you get much discourse with your political views of anybody from the other end of the spectrum? Or
I have been told by some nephews and nieces that they hate my blog because it's too conservative. So you can take it or leave it. And I say, so my response is, if you don't like it, then just ignore it, because a lot of people do. but if you like it and it resonates, then we're kindred spirits. And so I take a position and I say it like I think it and like I feel it. And really, what I'm all about is I'm not particularly trying to win anybody to my point of view, but I just want to go on the record as a witness of the days in which we live. And I have concerns both in the political arena and even in the church, that I think we're drifting off our moorings. And I think we confuse sometimes the political issues of the day and what the courts are telling us with what the gospel and what the doctrine suggests we should be doing. And I just want to be clear on and teach it as clearly as I possibly can what I think those distinctions are and need to be.
I've found as in my time with blogging is that it's, you know, just sitting down and writing about certain subjects, it can be the best teacher to yourself, is just forcing yourself to arrange and organize your thoughts on a specific topic. And to me, from my experience, I've learned additional information. I've had additional inspiration come as I've just sat down and forced myself to type it out. And I think more people would benefit by simply doing what you did and starting a simple blog and starting putting their thoughts down. Whether they're right or wrong, you might discover as you write what you truly do believe and what you do stand for. So I'm assuming that you've had similar experience if you sat down and maybe have you been writing for before this? It sounds like you wrote before, but you just didn't have a way to publish those things more publicly.
I've always been a writer and a journal keeper. I did that for many, many years. And when my daughter suggested that I write the blog, the mission for all of that was a continuation of my journal for my children. That was really all I anticipated doing. And what surprised me is that by putting it into a blog format, it's gone worldwide. The last time I looked at the analytics, my blog page had been downloaded in 26 countries, and that was quite surprising to me to realize how far-reaching the technology can be. And I get about it.
Wow, you're famous.
Well, I don't know about that. Maybe in one house or two around the world. but the thing that's interesting to me is that there are 1,000 hits on average in a week on my blog page based on Google searches. And so it's really quite surprising to me that it is what it is.
And I sat down and was thinking, but prior to our interview, you know, how I originally came across your information, and to be honest, I really don't remember, but I think it goes back to your post you put out there titled How Men and Women Share Priesthood Power. And you have a great diagram there. It was on April 7th of 2013 when that was posted. And really good information. And I took that and studied the different scriptures you shared and so forth. And so on your popular posts, there's kind of a mix of everything from doctrinal posts to political posts. So it seems like you're appealing to many individuals out there, and it looks like worldwide. That's great.
Let me tell you about the number two most popular hit has been Power and Covenants, Men, Women, and the Priesthood. And that was a book that my good friend Scott Strong and I wrote together many years ago, because at the time we had concern that we were as members of the church, there's a tendency to be tolerant and there's a tendency to be loving and kind. And that tendency was driving us farther and farther from the doctrinal mooring of the doctrines of the priesthood. And so the great discovery that Scott and I made together and that we wrote about on that in that book and in that manuscript was that priesthood power comes from individual righteousness, and the keys of the priesthood are distributed to men and women without distinction in the temple. When we go through the endowment, we all receive priesthood keys. Those are priesthood keys of power and of righteousness, as opposed to the administrative keys of the kingdom, which are held by men. And I wish we could have that discourse a little more openly in the church. Brother Oaks did a marvelous job in their most recent priesthood meeting describing the administrative keys of the priesthood and why they're held by men. And that's as it should be. But the rest of the story is the piece that's always missing, which is that men and women have priesthood keys of power. And they're very simple priesthood keys. And we fully explain that in the manuscript. And I think the reason that's risen over time into the second ranking is because of that fact. People are searching for an understanding of those true principles. And I believe if I can be a beacon with regard to those issues, that's where I can add, we can add the most in value and in contribution and as a current topic.
Yeah, great point for sure. So I encourage everybody to check that out. The blog entitled How Men and Women Share Priesthood Power. I'll link to it on the show notes for that. There's also other ones that have other articles on your blog, Dave, that have stood out to me. There one on blacks and the priesthood, the orderly transmission of priesthood keys. It's a great one. You've talked about more recently, as far as mothers in the patriarchal order of the priesthood, obviously that's kind of a hot topic in the last year or so. And so with those topics, you also referenced the time, your experience with your grandfather, President Lee, and his influence on you with studying the scriptures. This has always been a very difficult thing for me because I am not the type of person. I feel like I have an understanding of the scriptures, an understanding of the doctrine. Obviously, there's much more to learn, and I'm always striving to learn more. But I've never been the leader that can simply pull out of scriptures and turn to a verse and chapter and read the answer to their question. If they give me 5-10 minutes, I can usually get there. But the memorization of such things and so forth, and not that that's necessarily required, but maybe give me your perspective on simply studying the scriptures. What have you found that has worked? How have you become that individual that can have such a deep and vast knowledge of the doctrines of Jesus Christ?
Thank you for the compliment. I'm not sure it's true, but I'm trying.
Okay.
The answer is, in fact, it's very interesting that this would come up. Two nights ago, I was in an email exchange with a good brother who's serving a mission with his wife in Hawaii. And he asked me the same question. And I said to him, as I've said to many people, I've been asked that question 1,000 times. How do you study the scriptures? And truthfully, if you look at my copy of the Triple Combination, and I'll hold it up here, you won't be able to see it very well, maybe, but if I just open to any page, what you see is just a host of scribbling on all of this, and there is absolutely no methodology whatsoever.
Okay.
The key is constancy. There's no system in any of this. I've put in some inserts that I've added over the years, and when I found a quote that I particularly liked, I would type it out and insert it in the place in the scriptures where I thought it was the most topical. And so I did that over the years, and this would be a hard volume to give up just because it's become so personalized. But when you look at it, what you see is lots of different colors, and it really just depended on which pen I had in my hand at the moment. And that's as detailed and as systematic as it got. And it's not very systematic. But the key is, if you're constantly in the scriptures, and if you're, and the way I did it over the years was studying topically more than end to end. In other words, if I were teaching a class, for example, and the topic was the apostasy, then I would teach and research and dig in as deep as I could on all the sources associated with the apostasy, and there, by the way, there are many. And then I would continue to do that, and I'd cross-reference, and I would put scripture chains together, and then I could go back and refer to it on a regular basis, and that's how I did it. I just did it topically. For the most part, there have been times, and I've had wonderful experiences where, for example, I'll take the original edition of the Book of Mormon, and I'll have a feast with that, and you can read it in a matter of days, because it reads so much like a novel. And if you haven't had that experience, I encourage everybody to do that, because it's a very insightful exercise to see how the words fell from the mouth of the prophet and how they were written down. There's a lot of punctuation errors. There's a lot of grammatical errors. Anybody who says that the Book of Mormon fell from the prophet Joseph's lips in perfect grammar just hasn't been there and done that in terms of the original edition. But it's a feast of understanding how it came. And you just do that on a constant basis over a long, long period of time. Grandfather always used to say there's no royal road to learning. And his implication was you got to dig it out. You got to go search for it and you'll find it. I used to think that I was unique. And then Scott Strong, my good friend, and I used to talk about this all the time, about how special we must be, that the Lord was revealing all this stuff to us. And finally, one day I said to him, you know, I don't know that we're so special. I think that what sets us apart is we just asked. And he answered.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's encouraging. You know, I used to really beat myself up over the fact that, man, I'm not the leader that can pull out my scriptures and turn to something. But to be honest, there are topics that I can do that pretty well. And I think just over time, that'll come as I just stay in the scriptures and you, like that word you said, feast in the scriptures, and over time it'll work. So quote from your grandfather made me think of I recently finished President Eyring's biography, and in there he tells a story of working with President Lee. About, and he asked him the question, how does inspiration come? And he says, Hal, if you want to get revelation, do your homework. And I think that's exactly what you're saying, is you just got to dig in and you know, the answers aren't going to be floating on the surface. You have to really dig in and find them. So that's a great perspective. I appreciate you sharing that.
That's what I've found. I've found that if you treasure up the word of the Lord continually, he will give you the portion that you need in the very moment that you need it. And I've seen that play out 1,000 times. When I've been on the stand and faced with a speaking assignment and haven't known for sure what I was going to say, sometimes it goes right down to the wire, but the Spirit always bears testimony about where to go and what to say and how to say it so that I can be the answer to somebody's prayer. And that's all that I'm really interested in anymore. I don't really care about dropping a wagon load of knowledge on anybody. I'm more interested in, can I be the answer to somebody's prayer today?
That's great. That's great perspective. Well, let's pivot back a little bit more in just in our last few minutes here. Any other specific leadership principles that stood out as you think about not only your grandfather, President Lee, but also your father, leadership principles that you've used in your various callings and so forth that would be worth mentioning, or have we covered them all?
Let me come back to home teaching, because that's what my father's life work was all about. He was one of the 15 pilot stakes in the church that piloted the new and improved home teaching program back in the 60s. And he and his associates developed the personal priesthood interview. We don't really do that much anymore, but I remember thinking when I became a new elders quorum president, this is a big task to get everybody involved in home teaching. We've got 96 elders. How are we going to do it? And I decided that the way to eat that elephant was one bite at a time. And so I organized it into four districts. I assigned one of my counselors and myself and then one and the executive secretary to head up each of those districts. And we reported one district at a time each week. And so when our Tuesday night meeting came around, we knew by the report of that one district who had been missed. And on that night, we tailored our visits to the ones that had been missed in that district that week. So by the end of the month, we were doing 100% visits, and that's how we did it. We did the mop-up, but we were doing it in bite-sized pieces, so we were only making a few visits each week that were missed in the regular home teaching assignment. That's how we got 100%. It really wasn't very, it wasn't very scientific. It was just, how do you eat an elephant and we just decided to do it in small bite-sized chunks, and that's how we did it. And eventually what happened was, as we had personal priesthood interviews on a regular basis, every Sunday one district would report, and the home teachers got the message that we really did mean it, and if they didn't do it, we would go do it for them. And ultimately they all began to do it, and it was very edifying. And that was a principle that I learned early, and I think I learned that through observation more than anything else, and then by doing it. And when I became a bishop, I continued to do the same thing. Our bishopric meetings usually were held in the car on the way to somebody's house, and I underscore that again and again, because I had so many experiences where the people in my ward were so grateful that we would make the effort to come to their home and visit them, that they expressed that, and that was all the encouragement that we needed, was to be in their home, to show them and to demonstrate by love that we cared about them. And that was more important to me than just holding a meeting for the sake of holding a meeting.
Yeah, great point. That's great. So going back to PPIs, a lot of, as I talk with different elders quorum presidents, high priest group leaders and so forth, the big question I hear is they just sincerely don't know how to do a PPI. Any guidance on the practicalities of holding a PPI?
When I was on high councils, I would always, and I had a ward assignment, I would always teach these principles to elders quorum presidents. And what I would say to them is, it doesn't have to be a long and drawn out process. I was reporting, having a district report every week. So what that meant was that 15 minutes before the 3-hour block, this is back in the day when the 3-hour block was a novelty. And it was brand new. And so I thought, what a great habit to get into. Let's have them come 15 minutes early just for that district only. And we'll have a kneeling prayer. And we'll ask the Lord to help guide us in blessing the lives of these families. And that was all it was. We'd have a kneeling prayer. We'd ask the home teacher to offer it and then offer any insights that he had on the family and report on his home teaching for that month. And when you do it that way, a PPI takes maybe less than 3 minutes. And it doesn't have to be a long, drawn-out process. But the message that I was trying to convey was, you're not reporting to me as the Elders Quorum President or to one of the counselors. This is really between you and your family and the Lord. They're His children, and you are His steward, and you're standing in His stead. And you're reporting to the Lord on what you're doing to build that family as in their quest for eternal life. And for me, that was, I just always tried to boil it down to its essence. And what should the church be doing to help people in their quest for eternal life? And for me, it's not very complicated. That's how we did it.
And then lastly, as far as in the realm of leadership, you posted a blog called 4 Suggestions for Conducting Sacrament Meeting. And this has been in your top 10 of popularity on your blog. And I've read it, and I think there's some good sound advice here. The 4 things you mention in regards to conducting a sacrament meeting is 1, be on time. 2, don't try to be funny. 3, never give announcements over the pulpit. And 4, announce the whole program after the sacrament. And obviously people can go there and read that, but any highlights or more expounding you'd like to do on those?
It surprised me that one rose to the top. I really, when I wrote it, I really didn't think that would happen. But it indicates to me that there must be a need for it because so many people have looked it up online. And I think the one that I would underscore the most would be, don't try to be a comedian when you're conducting sacrament meeting. And I think a lot of people get out of line with that because they appreciate so much the good humor of great prophets like President Monson, who will ever forget wiggling his ears at a general priesthood meeting. But it's always done in such a self-deprecating way that they're masters at humor. But when you're attempting to conduct sacrament meeting, be cautious and be careful, because there are some people who come to sacrament meeting with their hearts full of grief, or they're searching for a spiritual upliftment. And if you're trying to just break the tension with comedy, it sometimes drives the spirit right out of the meeting. I've seen that happen again and again, where somebody tells a joke and it just drives the spirit right out the window. And that's the reason for not putting announcements for putting them in the written program rather than doing them over the pulpit. I can't tell you how many sacrament meetings have been disrupted by the stakeholder in the Pinewood Derby getting their 10 minutes of announcement time in a sacrament meeting. That's just not the place for it. That can all be done in a written program, yeah. I think. And again, the key is centering the sacrament meeting around the worship of the Savior and our Father in Heaven.
Yeah, you know, going back to avoiding being a comedian, one thing to take to note is that the purpose of General Conference and the purpose of sacrament meeting, they've got two different purposes as far as meetings go. And so some humor may work in a General Conference that would just not be appropriate in a sacrament meeting. But I think that's sage advice there. And you know, it's a tough balance at the same time, because I've worked with counselors as my time as bishop. You know, some of them get up there and they've been so monotone. I tell them, like, Okay, let a little bit of your personality come through, because nobody's listening to you. You sound so boring, and people are just falling asleep because you're trying to be robotic up there. Like, you know, add a little bit, but yeah, let's not go crazy. And I don't need you to have a comedy bit ready to go, or a prepared joke or anything like that. So, but yeah, great advice there. So, well, David, I appreciate this conversation. I've really benefited from it. It's probably gone longer than I first promised you, but definitely a lot of information here. Anything we've missed, additional thoughts you've had that would be worth mentioning?
No, I don't think so. I think the church, basically, if my blog is any indication, I started it in a rather naive way. But it was really just an attempt, in very simple terms, to explain myself, I guess, to my family, and hopefully leave them a record that they could refer back to long after I'm gone. And if it does anything beyond that, then that's just gravy and icing on the cake. So my goal was just try to not embarrass them publicly, and then be a blessing to anyone else that I could be. And I think if I can add any encouragement to other members of the church, I'd say, try the same thing if you have the inclination to write. For me, it's been very cathartic, and I've always loved writing. And as you suggested, I wrote many, many years before that. I was an avid journal keeper. I read a lot. And for me, it was just a natural extension of who I am and what I believe. And I think we have an awesome opportunity as members of the church to do that. And we never know where it'll go. In my case, it's gone into 26 countries, and I'm humbly grateful for that, and I hope it blesses lives. And I think maybe more of us can do the same kinds of things.
This concludes the interview with David Goetz. I encourage you to visit leadinglds.com and leave a comment on this post. Give us your feedback, ideas, and thoughts. Also, while you're at Leading LDS, the very top of the screen will be a button where you can sign up for the newsletter of Leading LDS so that you can be more part of our community and get each post directly delivered to your inbox. Until next time.